The new issue with which we want to deal with, the new question to which we want to answer is, can we obtain the velocity in a certain way? And in particular, could we obtain the velocity as the derivative of the output of a position transducer? And vice versa. Could we obtain a position by using the integral function of an eventual velocity information given by a possible existing transducer? The answer typically is no. The problem in this case is due to the presence of the noise. In the figure, in slide 24, noise is represented as white Gaussian typical distribution with respect to the possible working frequencies. That is, the noise more or less features the same amount if we consider different working frequencies. What does it mean, this? This noise can affect the output of a position transducer. So if we take this output and we apply to it the derivative function, clearly we will derivate, we will apply this function both to the signal, to the good signal component of the output of the transducer, but even to the noise. And since the noise has this behavior with respect to the frequencies, clearly it will have a behavior like the figure in the right part of the slide that more or less increases, augments with the frequency. This means that by working at high frequencies, the derivation could increase in a very significant and not acceptable the presence of the noise, its bad contribution, and of course this cannot be accepted by the engineers. One could say, I apply a low-pass filter just to filter the noise. But if we are working at high frequencies, that is, if the process, the electronic circuits, are characterized by very high values of omega, this is not possible because this would correspond to cut those velocities components at which we are interested. Moreover, if a transducer is characterized by a certain level of non-linearities, imaging for example the potentiometer, into which the transfer function is a set of levels with non-continuity passages from one level to the other one. We called this transfer function a staircase behavior. Okay, in this case, to perform the derivative function of such a kind of behavior of mathematical function will bring us to have several points into which the amplitude of the derivative is theoretically infinite, in practice very high and not suitable for our control purposes. Of course, this set of considerations are valid even if we try to apply the opposite direction, the opposite, let's say, algorithm. Since we have said that it is not possible to make the derivative function of the output of a transducer that provides us the linear measurement of an object, this clearly requires to introduce suitable velocity transducer. So one could say, okay, a velocity transducer gives to me a suitable output. Can I integrate, can I apply the integral function to that output to obtain back the position of the object? The answer is no, in particular when we are working at low frequencies. Why this? Because as exactly we said for the derivative function, when we apply the integral function to whatever magnitude in the domain, in the Laplace domain, this is equivalent to divide this quantity by S, or if you want, is equivalent to multiply this quantity by 1 on S. And clearly, this term will be divergent at low frequencies, so causing the explosion, let's say, of the magnitude that we have integrated. And again, if this magnitude, if this signal consists of a good signal component plus a noise component, this is not acceptable because it corresponds to a very high noise contribution that will ruin the evaluation of the signal, so making our measurement consistently wrong. For this reason, we consider some suitable linear velocity transducers. In this case, we see only one of them due to the fact that in most cases the velocity that is measured is an angular one, and again by means of a screw, that angular measurement is reported to a linear velocity measurement. The linear velocity transducer that is presented into this course is the so-called electromagnetic transducer that is made basically by a set of coils, a solenoid, that is crossed by a nucleus of ferromagnetic material. This nucleus is connected to the object that is moving and whose velocity must be evaluated. The nucleus is a permanent magnet, so it has a north pole and a south pole. Again, this nucleus will induce a variation in the electronic condition of the solenoid into which it enters or from which it exits, depending on the movement that is performed by the object, and the flux variation of the magnetic field developed by the yellow nucleus with respect to the signal present in the solenoid will give us an information that we can relate to the velocity of the object itself. In fact, looking at slide 25, we can say that the flux of the magnetic field that is coupled with the solenoid is given by the product of the number of the coils enchained with the magnet, that is, that are crossed by the flux lines of the magnetic field provided by the nucleus, time the flux for every single coil considered, that is phi b. So phi c, the flux enchained, is given by nc, the number of the coils considered, time the flux for one single coil phi b. But the number of the coils enchained, nc, is given by the product of the density, n lowercase, time the distance that is crossed due to the entering or to the exiting of the nucleus with respect to the solenoid we are considering. Again, we use the so-called Faraday-Neumann law that says that the variation in the voltage inducted into the solenoid is given by the derivative function applied to the enchained flux. So for us, this means to make the derivation with respect to time of Nc time phi b. Nc, in turn, is given by n small and lowercase time x. So the derivative function can be applied to the only variable magnitude in such a kind of formula, that is x, and the derivative of x with respect to the time is the velocity. So finally, we obtain that the voltage induced into the solenoid is the product of the density of coils versus length unit, the number of the coils versus the length unit, the flux for every coil of the solenoid times the velocity. And we have a direct relationship between the voltage we measure and the velocity we want really measure. Consider that we can have the solenoid supplied with a suitable voltage. This means that we will try to observe the variation in this power supply that we provide to the solenoid due to the induction effects relative to the movement of the nucleus. Clearly, the measurement is approximated if the solenoid is supplied with an alternate current, with an alternate voltage. It is necessary to add to the transducer a rectifier to obtain a signal that can be managed by the microprocessor. And finally, again, like many transducers of such a kind, this device is suitable for measuring small velocities. In fact, if the velocity is big, it is better to transform the linear movement, the linear displacement, into an angular one by measuring the angular velocity. One of the most applied and used transducers in this sense is the encoder, in particular, as we have understood, the incremental encoder. We have already in this lesson described how the incremental encoder works, and we have also illustrated a suitable algorithm that is able to detect the direction of the rotation and the amount of the rotation itself. For example, looking at the figure 26, we have a pulse sequence relative to the two channels corresponding to the two signals coming from the crowns of the encoder. And the situation that is identified here is a clockwise rotation into which we know that the B channel is a little bit delayed with respect to the A channel. In other words, edges on the B channel follows the edges on A channel, and in particular we see that when the A channel or the A signal features suitable edges, the values assumed by A are always different from the values assumed by the B signal. This could be formalized, let's say, expressed by a suitable algorithm like that is shown in the blue square, that says that if B is changed, if we identify a commutation on B, we have to check the values between the two channels. And if the two channels are equal, we increment the counter the counting variable because this is a clockwise rotation. Otherwise, we decrement the counting value because it is a counterclockwise rotation. This is the case of the figure of shown in slide 26, where when we detect commutations in B, we have that A and B are equal, so we increment correctly the counting value because this is a clearly a clockwise rotation. As we have already said, the same check can be performed on the A signal, and in this case the situation is reversed, that is, if an edge has been found on A, depending on the fact that A is equal B or different from B, we will decrement or increment the counting value corresponding the equality between A and B to the counterclockwise rotation, the difference between the values of A and B to the clockwise rotations. So, to perform such a kind of algorithm, we need, of course, an encoder, an incremental encoder, a port of a microprocessor to which the two outputs of the encoder are connected, and a software like this that is able to understand amount and direction. As we have several times already said, in some cases when the rotation velocity is particularly high, the software acquisition from the microprocessor is replaced by the usage of suitable counters with the microprocessor periodically checking the value stored into the counters. After having counted several movements in clockwise or counterclockwise direction, we can divide the number of the counting we have determined in such a way by a suitable delta t, that is, by a suitable time duration, and clearly the ratio between the counting value and the time interval is a approximated measurement, better to say an average estimation of the velocity of the object that is rotating. It is possible to follow a different approach, that is, it is also possible to count the time that has expired between one pulse of the two channels A and B and its next repetition. The approach is exactly the same if we count a suitable number of small clock cycles between two pulses provided by one of the two crowns. We will have again an approximated but affordable, if a high number of clock cycles have been counted, approximated but by good, I repeat again, estimation of the velocity of the object we are interested to. One of the most popular and diffused transducer for the measurement of the angular velocity is the so-called tachometric dynamo, also defined as a ring of Pacinotti, from the name of the scientists who firstly conceived it. The tachometric dynamo provides in output a voltage that is proportional to the angular velocity of the object that is under measurement, so it is a very linear transducer that is also able to give a voltage enough high to avoid the presence of an operational amplifier. In other words, for current velocities that the dynamo can measure, the voltage is in practice ready to be converted in binary and to be sent to the port of a microprocessor for the measurement. Moreover, the characteristics of this transducer make it able to measure even very high velocities. Its structure consists of a permanent magnet. It's represented in slide 28 by the blue figure. This magnet is conceived with a particular shape. We could say that it has a C shape, I mean like the letter C. But there is an area into which two expansions surround a circular ring made by a ferromagnetic material that is called rotor, since it is mounted on a shaft that is connected with the object under measurement. The rotor is represented by that magenta circle in the figure and is wounded with a wire. So basically we have a ferromagnetic device with a solenoid that surrounds it in throughout its length. In the blue figure we see the direction of the magnetic field flux lines that of course will follow the shape of the nucleus that has a magnetic permeability, a very high magnetic permeability. So it is reasonable that the magnetic flux lines will reproduce the shape of the nucleus. But when they have to cross the air between the expansions and the rotor, they are, let's say, helped by the shape of the final part of the two expansions that are defined as they were bird tail. In other words, their shape is conceived in such a way that the lines exit from the surface of those expansions and enter into the surface of the rotor in a perpendicular fashion. So you can see that the direction of those red dot lines that exit from the expansion is vertical, and with the same direction they will enter into the surface of the rotor. Inside the rotor they continue their road following the shape of the rotor, because even the rotor features a very high permeability, and then they exit from the rotor, entering again vertically, it is better to say with a perpendicular direction to the surface of the expansion itself, joining to the remaining flux lines that are present in throughout the nucleus itself. Why the shapes of the expansions are designed in such a way is to favor the magnetic coupling between the flux lines and the coils wounding the rotor. In fact, the ring is inserted into the magnetic field generated by the permanent magnet, the nucleus, and due to the rotation, an electric field is generated in the space and an electromotive force in each rotating coil. This is what is said, what is defined by the so-called Lorentz law, that is shown in slide 29. into which we have that E, the generated electric field, is the product between the magnetic field B and the velocity V. Expressions in this formula are not vectors, but the modules of the vectorial magnitudes, because the symmetry between them is perfectly perpendicular. And now it is clear the reason why the shape of the expansions was conceived in such a way. The product between B and V, V is the direction of the velocity, of the linear velocity, due to the rotation of the rotor, and B is the magnetic field represented by the lines, those red dotted lines in the previous figure. The product is the module of B time the module of the velocity, time the sinus of the angle that they have, but since this angle is 90 degrees, the sine is 1, and the coupling between the magnetic field and the direction of the velocity is as maximum as possible. So we can say that the shape of the expansions is in favor to the generation of the maximum possible electric field. The situation is well represented in the upper part of the figure, of the slide, into which we see a couple of arms, symmetric arms, it is better to say, that are characterized by some coils of the solenoid that wounds the rotor. They are characterized by the velocity vector, and we clearly see the direction of the magnetic field in the left picture, exiting from the expansions and entering into the rotor itself, and in the right arm, in the right picture, exiting from the rotor and going towards the expansion of the C nucleus. Since we have an electric field, by making the circulation of the electric field time the length of the electronic circuit present in this area, we will have an estimation of the voltage of the electromotive force inducted on it, inducted inside the electronic circuit. Consider that the electronic circuit we are talking about is represented by each of the coils that are present in the two arms that wound the two arms we are seeing in the picture. Considering the coils, we can imagine them as composed by four parts. Two of them are circular. The first is located in front to the expansion of the nucleus, in the figure where the arrow with the magnetic field is indicated. And the other one is itself circular shape, but is located in the internal part of the rotor, below the arm. The other two portions of the coil are vertical and connect the two circular ones. The first is visible in the figure and joins the circle in front of the nucleus to the circle in the internal part. The other portion is behind the arm, and in practice connect this coil with the next one. If we consider the voltage in each one of them, we know that is produced by the product between the electronic field generated and the length of the portion itself. Due to the vectorial product of the magnetic field and the velocity, the direction of the electronic field generated is perpendicular to the plane into which the magnetic field and the vector are located. This is the well-famous three fingers of the right hand rule. In this case, due to the direction of the magnetic field and of the velocity, the direction of the electronic field enters into the plane. But we clearly see that it is perpendicular to the direction of those two portions of the coil that connect the two circular ones. In particular, E, the electric field E, will be vertical with respect to the direction of the wire that is visible onto the arm, and also the direction of the wire that is behind the arm itself. This means that the scalar product will not give any contribution, since the scalar product will have the cosine of the angle that is zero. The only two portions of the coil that will provide a contribute are the circular ones. But if you consider where the magnetic field is, that is between the arm of the rotor and the nucleus, the expansion of the magnetic nucleus, we can say that internally to the rotor we don't have any electric field, so we don't have any coupling between the electric field and the wire of the coil. Also in this case we must say that the scalar product is zero. The only term that will provide a real voltage is the circular part that is in front to the magnetic nucleus. In this case, in this part of the coil, there is a voltage different from zero. But if you consider the other arm shown in the picture, the symmetric one, you can repeat the same considerations, and you will arrive to conclude that even in this case the voltage will be present only in the circular part of the coil that is just in front to the other magnetic nucleus. But in this case the direction of the velocity vector of the magnetic field B, and for this reason of the electric field E, will be different than before. In particular, E will be still perpendicular to the plane into which V and B are located, but its direction will be opposite with respect to before. This means that the voltage induced in the circular portion of the coil will be equal to its correspondent one in the other arm, but with the opposite sign due to the different directions of the magnitudes we have considered. So, the net sum of these two voltages will be zero. We can say that such a kind of considerations can be repeated for every couple of symmetric coils. So, considering all the solenoidal development of the winding around the rotor, no voltage inside it is present. But if we insert two contact clamps located, let's say, one in the north position and one in the south position, considering the circle, that is the shape of the rotor, We can conclude that making the difference between the voltage taken by the first clamp with respect to the voltage taken by the second clamp that is equal but opposite in sign, we will have a voltage different from zero at the edges of the two wires connected to the clamps. And this voltage is proportional to the velocity of the ring. Now, let's see why this is true. If we look at all the coils from the point of view made by the two clamps we have introduced into the transducer, we can say that every coil is a voltage generator, so we can see them as half distributed in the left part of the rotor, considering the couple of clamps, and half of them are located in the right part of the rotor, again considering the two clamps. So if we would like to express, to depict such a situation with an electronic equivalent circuit, we could draw the picture shown in slide 30, into which we have that group of voltage generator that are in parallel with respect the two contacts clamps we have put in the rotor that exert during the rotation a contact with the upper part, the upper circular part of every coil. So if n is the total number of the coils, the voltage that we can measure at the two edges of the circuit is n half time the medium, the average voltage that is contained in every coil. We can estimate such a kind of voltage since it is given by the previous formula that said that the electronic field is the product of the magnetic field times the voltage, and the voltage is the product between the electric field and the length of the coil involved. This means that the average voltage induced is the product of the average magnetic field that shots the surface of the rotor time the length of the part of the coil involved, we call it L uppercase, time the velocity. In expressing such a formula, we introduce clearly an approximation when we say that BM is the magnetic field perpendicular to the surface of the ring and to the velocity, because the overall voltage induced in every part of the coil is not only due to the line of a single magnetic field, but is due to all the fluxes that exit from the expansion of the nucleus and touching it, we could say. So some of them are really perpendicular to the direction of the coil part itself. Some others no. And for this reason we should include several terms in the overall magnetic field, some of which are really given by the product between BM and the velocity, considered as perpendicular each one to the other. But other terms should be included into which this perpendicularity is not respected, and the contribute should be multiplied by a sinus term. Of course, this would make the formula very complicated. It's not the scope of the course and of the description of the transducer. For this reason, we simplify the general definition by introducing an average magnetic field that contains all these contributes without better specifying them. L uppercase is the ring thickness and the length of the coil irradiated by the field. This is interesting to notice because respecting the so-called Gauss law, we have to say that the flux that irradiates the coil is given by the integral of the product of the magnetic field time the surface that is irradiated. And since this surface corresponds to half the sphere that encapsulates ideally the shape of the rotor, this surface is expressed by the product of P Greek time the radius of this ideal sphere time the thickness of the nucleus expansion itself time, of course, the medium magnetic field. So we can summarize, joining all these magnitudes that we have defined, and we can conclude that the voltage is n half the product between average magnetic field, thickness of the nucleus, and velocity. By replacing in this expression the magnetic field with the expression obtained by the Gauss law, we will have n half time the flux divided the P Greek time the radius, all multiplied by the velocity. And finally, we will have, after one more step, a complete proportionality with respect to the frequency. The frequency is something that is completely related to the angular rotation velocity, because we know that 2π Greek times the frequency is the expression of omega, the rotation velocity. So we have found a perfect relationship between the voltage provided and measurable at the two clamps of the circuit, that is given by the number of the coils that are included into the circuit, into the solenoid, the flux of the magnetic field, and basically the rotation velocity. So the linearity of the transducer is evident, and we can also modify the sensibility of the transducer itself by increasing, of course, up to a certain threshold, the number of the coils that wound the solenoid, the rotor, I mean, and the intensity of the magnetic field in the permanent magnet. We can conclude this description of the tachometric dynamo with some final considerations that are shown in the slide 31. First of all, the transducer provides very high voltages that are usable immediately without the need of operational amplifiers or other kind of conditioning about the signal. The sensibility is 10 volts on 1000 round per minute, so the voltages that are provided are in the range of the analog to digital converter needed for converting it in a binary number that can be acquired by a microprocessor. The only advice that it could be given is to put between the converter and the dynamo a buffer. Even if the output impedance of this device is very low, because its nature is completely electromagnetic, so we don't imagine any capacitor or parasite capacitor presence, it is better in any case to separate the acquisition part in the circuit from the elaboration part of the chain made up by the ADC, the converter, and the microprocessor itself. Rather, we have a small ripple effect due to how the system is carried out. In fact, if we imagine the two clamps that exert a temporary contact between the superior part of each clamp and the next one during the rotation, we can understand that the shape of the output voltage is the one shown in the right lower part of the slide 31. Considering each coil, the output voltage included into this coil is basically a sinusoidal voltage. And this is very compliant and understandable with the fact that that coil describe a circular rotation with respect to the magnetic field that irradiates it. So there is a point into which the coupling is maximum, another point into which is maximum but with an opposite sign, and other two positions into which the coupling is minimum. This is what is perfectly represented by a sinusoidal waveform. But the part of this waveform that is captured by the clamps during the temporary contact is the superior one, is the, let's say, top. So we have to imagine the output voltage as a sequence of several tops of these sinusoidal waveforms joined together. And the overall waveform of the output voltage is a slightly oscillating waveform that is not a sinusoidal waveform itself, but simply a signal that is featuring a ripple with respect to a continuum value proportional to the rotation velocity, with an amplitude of these oscillations that is very, very small and is, let's say, confined within the 1-2% with respect to the continuum value. It is not possible to filter this small oscillation, because this oscillation is given by the rotation itself. So the frequency of this rotation is exactly the frequency of the phenomenon we want to measure. And if we include in this kind of electronic circuit a filter, a low-pass filter, of course, that cuts that kind of a frequency, we will lose the measurement that we want to perform. The only solution that we can apply to this problem is the use of particular tachometric dynamos without clamps, so preventing from this effect, and also preventing from the noise due to the sliding contacts, and also from the usage due to the long life of the transducer that sooner or later will oblige to replace the transducer itself. But this second version of tachometric dynamos is quite more expensive than the previous one we have seen, so there is a trade-off to be considered between the quality of the signal and the cost of the transducer that sometimes suggests one choice and other times suggests the other one.